Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Because the problem with collecting unique things is if the rest of the world loses interest in them, their value evaporates overnight. So when I was a boy, it was all the rage in the United States to collect beer cans, vintage beer cans. You know, if you found a 20-year-old can with a pop top, a Bullfrog beer from Wisconsin was the most valuable can that you could find. And I had about 600 cans. I had a fairly formidable collection that was probably worth thousands of dollars at the time. Well, fast forward 30 years, when my mother insisted that I take these cans out of the crawl space in our house, nobody collects beer cans anymore. So this vintage collection, the only value I had left was recycling. You know, the Bullfrog beer, people looked at it as kind of a rusted can and said, well, you know, what's so good about that? It doesn't even have beer in it anymore. So the uniqueness can be a bit of a dangerous game.
The greatest wealth is to live content with little. The insightful words of Greek philosopher Plato. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What is money? How do we understand it? And is making it an art? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with one of the sharpest brains in finance, Dr. Charles Whelan of Dartmouth College in the US, the author of the best-selling Naked Economics and Naked Statistics series, whose latest installment, Naked Money, a revealing look at our financial system, explores some of the cultural, political, and psychological kinks around money. In Naked Money, Charles Whelan argues, for most people, the most attractive thing about the Bitcoin has been its steadily rising value. If you buy an asset primarily in the hope that it will rise in value, you are speculating. And if you are speculating on an asset that has no underlying value, watch out for the bubble. The greater fool theory, buying something today in the belief that someone else will pay more for it tomorrow, has had a seat at the table of every bubble in the history of human civilization. So what determines the value of anything, and is it all a confidence game?
Well, hello. My name is Charlie Whelan. I teach public policy at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire in the United States. I spent many years before that teaching at the University of Chicago. My doctorate actually is in public policy. So although I'm interested in monetary policy and statistics and economics, my real passion is applying all of these things to the important issues of the day. Naked Money is my most recent book. It's the third in the Naked series, which is not quite as bad as it sounds. I first wrote Naked Economics, and the idea was to take the most important concepts and strip away some of the extraneous detail. I then wrote Naked Statistics, which did the same thing, and now we're at Naked Money, which looks at what money is, how central banks work, things like the euro and other monetary agreements, because they have a huge impact on day-to-day life.
Really well done, Charlie, on the book. I have to say I learned a lot about financial systems and the whole nature of economic play in global politics and social structures. You ask some tremendous questions in this book that are so relevant to how we're all living and operating in the world. So hats off to you on that one. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off and we can play it by ear from there. What do you think the euro has accomplished?
Well, the euro certainly has accomplished more economic integration, as has the European Union in general. I traveled in Europe in the 1980s and, of course, did all the border stops every time I crossed from Czechoslovakia to Germany, from East Germany to West Germany, from Germany to France, which is quite disruptive for a traveler. One can think about the euro as doing the same thing only for trade. So now if you're selling potatoes in Germany from France, you no longer have to stop, pay a different custom, and most important, operate with a different currency, a different exchange rate, an exchange rate that may fluctuate over time. So it eases both travel for those of us who are moving through the borders, that's the wider integration, but then it also eases the uncertainty that arises when countries are using different currencies.
You argue, though, in the book that the future of the euro is to some degree in question. So I'm just wondering about that.
It's highly uncertain. I mean, one thing to do is to step back and compare the United States to the European Union. Both of them are about the same size geographically. They're broadly similar in population. They each have distinct political units. If you think about the 50 United States and all the European nations that have adopted the euro, so one might think that both of them are equally stable. After all, there's really no discussion of the United States each adopting a different currency. That would be silliness. The difference is that the European Union does not have some of the features and institutions that make the United States dollar work. In particular, there's less labor mobility. There is, of course, a legal guarantee that people can move across the European Union, but there are strong cultural reasons that somebody might not be able to relocate, say, from Italy to Germany in search of jobs, and that makes the integration less perfect. It's also true that there are not the same macro stabilizers across the European Union that there are in the United States. One of the things that makes the dollar work is if part of the United States is in economic distress, say because of low oil prices, Texas and Oklahoma are struggling, the federal government in the United States can move resources, payments, can lower taxes in the affected region and so on, so that it can ease the differential in economic output between regions, which then takes any pressure off the currency. The European Union has a lot fewer tools in that regard. So part of what puts stress on the euro is the lack of economic integration to kind of make it complete.
It's all very ironic, isn't it? I know you argue somewhere in the book that the US dollar is the greatest form of currency that could ever have been conceived because it gives that stability.
Well, any kind of paper currency is really kind of is a miracle. So the mere fact that we've moved from shells and bags of salt and tobacco to a gold-backed currency, which wreaked all kinds of havoc in the 1930s, to a piece of paper that, you know, the dollar being widely respected around the world. I just finished a long trip, and a $100 bill, believe me, will get me just about anything I want in any country on the planet. So, and it's just a piece of paper. So that the currency itself is a remarkable evolution, but also the fact that the dollar itself, because so many people recognize and respect it around the world, is an amazing economic production.
I've done a lot of traveling, and I will always go with a dollar, no matter what part of the world I'm going to, Southeast Asia, South America, Africa, wherever, because no matter what tight jam you get into, people understand whatever service they're providing or whatever situation you want to get in or get out of. The $20, $40, whatever, it's ultimately recognisable as mobility, so to speak, isn't it?
It is. Now, that said, you'll find some very quirky things as you travel. So I was in Myanmar, where they're only happy to get their dollars, but they will only take currency issued after 2006. Now, here in the United States, that makes no sense whatsoever. Nobody, if you give them a $100 bill, they don't care if it was produced in 2002 or 2006 or 2017. But once people in that country understand that other people only accept bills issued after a certain date, then they will only accept bills issued after a certain date. They also required that the bills be perfectly crisp, not even a single crease, you know, as if they had just come from the mint, which again, in the United States would be unrecognizable. You can wad up a bill and send it through the washing machine and somebody will still take it. So there's a certain degree to which other people's expectations about what currency will be accepted then determines what currency I'm willing to accept. There's a certain confidence game embedded in all of this.
Yeah, it's funny, like if you travel to India and, you know, you throw out some rupees no matter what situation you're in, you can have the most dirtiest rupees half torn and people will accept it. Whereas if you go to places, you know, some parts of Africa, they get very touchy about the hygienic quality of their money and also what date it was produced. And there's a huge amount of paranoia on it. It can be very unsettling for as a traveller, can't it?
It absolutely can. And of course, you as the traveler then continue that tradition. So as soon as you learn in one of these countries that people won't accept a torn bill, then you'll stop accepting a torn bill, which means other people won't accept a torn bill. So, you know, there is a certain amount of confidence that underlies any currency in any place. What you have to appreciate what other people are willing to accept And that will in turn shape your beliefs about what you're willing to accept, which then feeds back into the larger system. I mean, when you think about some of this stuff, it kind of it can be a bit mind-blowing.
Yeah, but counterfeit money is a reality no matter where you go to. Whether you can be in Ireland, America, you can be parts of Africa, Central America, wherever it is, it makes no difference. It is a reality, and it's just that in certain countries you're more tuned into it because there is much more of the black market.
Yes, and there's some stories in the book about intriguing counterfeit things. So, you know, one is that North Korea, which is continues to be in the headlines for all kinds of nefarious activities. One of those activities that gets less attention than, say, the nuclear weapons or incarcerating American tourists is they're quite good counterfeiters. And so North Korea is notorious for counterfeiting the American $100 bill, and it's one way that the country can pay its bills. Now, on the other hand, there are stories, Somalia is one place, where people have willingly accepted what they knew to be counterfeit bills because they were so well done that they circulated almost as well as the originals. And then, of course, in Somalia, because the central government had collapsed and so on. So even counterfeit money has some strange elements to it.
What's the difference between money and wealth? I imagine as an economist and as an academic, you would look at it as vastly different, do you?
They are, in fact, vastly different. So money is best thought of as a subset of wealth. It's one tiny piece, often, of your wealth. And it's the only piece of your wealth that's highly liquid, meaning that you can use it almost immediately to conduct a transaction. So, for example, as I look around my office here, I have a beautiful print by a famous photographer on the wall. I probably paid $800 for it. That's not money, because if I take it off the wall and carry it to the golf course and say I'd like to play this afternoon and get a lesson, here's a framed print, they're going to look at me cross-eyed. So there are all kinds of things. Jewelry is hard to make liquid because you got to find somebody who's willing to sell it. Real estate, obviously, is a source of wealth, but it's difficult to use to conduct transactions. So money, particularly in the form of dollar bills or other things like that, is the piece of wealth that we use to conduct transactions quite easily.
What do you think most about at night, money or wealth?
I think a lot more about wealth. there's a story in the book that, you know, Warren Buffett, at any given moment, might not have much money. You know, if I show up and Warren happens to be behind me at Starbucks and he's left his wallet behind, he may have no money. Warren Buffett could have no money just because his wallet's empty. But I would certainly rather have his wealth than his money. He's got plenty of wealth. So wealth, at the end of the day, is what determines our well-being. And for most of us, if you have stocks and bonds and real estate, with a little bit of work, you can turn some of that money into wealth. But if you have, you know, $1,000 in your wallet and no other wealth, you're really not that well off.
I'm just wondering, you spent so much time understanding and writing about money and economic systems. Just wondering, do you think we ever get an honest answer from anybody about money? Because whether it's friends, family, employers, whatever it is, you know what I mean? You don't have to be bartering to actually try and get the crude reality and facts about what people are doing with their money. We get all very paranoid, private, and a bit tricky when it comes to money in all aspects of our life, don't we? Like if you ask somebody about their wages or if you know, the price of their house and stuff, it can be very off, you know?
It is. You know, there was a New Yorker article a while back that said people systematically lie about three things: money, sex, and the length of their commute. So I don't know whether the commute one applies in Ireland or not, but it certainly does in the United States. People always downplay the length of their commute because they're wasting so much time and they realize that sex is quite obvious, and money for all the reasons that you outlined. But this is one reason, by the way, that I think we're never going to get rid of paper currency like the dollar or the euro, even with the rise of Bitcoin and checking accounts and credit cards. And the reason is that there's a certain amount of anonymity that derives from having a $100 bill. Nobody needs to know who's got it. Nobody needs to know where you spent it. Yeah. But that's obviously great for criminals, so it can be a problem. But I think the rest of us also appreciate the degree to which we can use cash and not necessarily leave tracks behind.
Do you think it could be argued that some countries or some nationalities are more, more direct about money than others? Like whether it's the Italians can be a bit messy or whatever it is. Do you think there's some kind of national characteristics about money Because again, if we come back to India, you know, one of the enjoyable aspects of going to and traveling to India is, besides some of the wonderful food and interesting sights to see, is all the bartering and messing around money. Like, it's a bit of a laugh. Do you know what I mean? But there's other countries that, you know, it all becomes very firm. Like, if you ever go to Japan, there's no messing as to price. There's no negotiating. It's this and that it alone, you know?
Oh, I think that's one of the joys of travel, as you alluded to. And again, I've just come back from a 9-month trip. There are all kinds of differentials, both about how people deal with money and transactions, the haggling. I mean, there are certain countries in Africa and Southeast Asia where people are deeply offended if you don't bargain over something. I don't think the Germans and, as you said, the Japanese are quite so keen on bargaining. In the United States, you can bargain for a few things, but not many. But I also think there are differences about the use of cash, for example. Some societies are much more cash intensive. India was one of them. And as people may have read recently, Prime Minister Modi made a dramatic change there. India used, particularly the rich, used a lot of cash, sometimes to avoid taxes, sometimes to avoid black market activities being detected. And what Prime Minister Modi did was eliminate some of the higher rupee bills. I think maybe the 2,000 rupee note, I may get it wrong, but essentially eradicated all the big rupee notes and said you have, I think, 24 hours to turn them in for smaller notes in hopes of flushing out all this dark money from the system and going forward, making it hard for people on the black market to deal with their nefarious activities because they had to use so many small bills. So yes, there are vast differences across countries in how people talk about wealth, how they conduct business with money, and with the money itself.
You could also argue there, Charlie, that in a relationship, whether it's in a marriage or whatever it is, money plays a big part, and how two different people will handle and understand and the risks they're willing to take with money can be quite a deciding factor whether the relationship will stay together or not. Because, you know, money is so central to life. So if one is rather careless or another, lover likes to take, you know, massive gambles with money, that can be perilous, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. On many dimensions, several of which you alluded to, obviously, wealth is a big source of contention. People have different notions of what it means to be rich or to be content. So they may have very different notions about how they want to spend their time, whether somebody wants to work ceaselessly so that they can have lots of money in the bank. Other people may want to enjoy the moment and live more simply. And that's a fundamental life question. But there's also a certain amount a degree to which money is power. And of course, you bring two people into a relationship with different resources that they bring into the relationship, different earning powers. And so they you have to navigate that. So there's no doubt but that money and wealth and the employment that generates it are serious stressors in any relationship.
And also, how much is enough? Somebody may be happy at 60 to retire with a couple of quid in the bank, and others, you know, would find, you know, unless they have a minimum of a certain large amount, that they would be taking a risk and they need to work till they're 70. It's amazing, all, you know, you could get a whole group of friends together, and how much is enough, whether it's how much we pay ourselves, how much we think we're worth, or even how much is, you know, what price or value you put on possessions or certain things in your life. It's also varied, isn't it?
It is, and I'm surprised that people have actually not spent even more time discussing this question of how much is enough. I think we as Americans are particularly guilty of not thinking very deeply about it. I mean, here we are in one of the richest countries in the history of human civilization, and most of us get 2 weeks of vacation. I mean, the Europeans put us to shame, in part because those cultures have said, you know, this many weeks of work is enough. And we'd rather spend 4 or 5 or 6 weeks of leisure with our family than have more stuff, which we can purchase by working those extra weeks. That's an important question. The retirement is an important question. You know, I said at the outset that I'd written some books on economics. When you go back and look at some of the big thinkers in economics, most of them assumed that as society got richer, we would work fewer and fewer hours. You go back to, the 1920s, and people assumed that if we became twice as rich, we would only work 20 hours a week. So it is kind of a puzzle that as we've grown steadily richer, we continue to work 40 and 50 hours a week and then buy bigger houses, more cars, and things of that nature. Perhaps because of the environmental implications, we may revisit that question again.
Well, I would think that time is wealth, and within that peace of mind, and that you can't put a price on that, that that is what life is all about.
It is. I mean, I suppose you can try and put a price on it, to the extent that if someone's going to offer me money to, say, write another article or do another book, I know pretty much how much time I'm going to have to give up. And really, it is the time. I mean, certainly all my basic needs are met. My kids are going to go to college. I eat every day. My house is fine. So at that point, I am explicitly trading off the time it will take against whatever they're going to pay me to do it. But I agree with your fundamental premise, which is you can create more money, you can buy more stuff, but each of us, Warren Buffett or me or Bill Gates, only has 24 hours in the day.
I'm just wondering, in your acknowledgements, you write that the book was very hard to write, and you say it's the substance is hard. And you talk about the challenges in, you know, writing about financial systems and monetary policy in terms of making it interesting and accessible to readers. So can you tell me about that? Because it's interesting that money pervades every aspect of our lives and relationships and our lived experience of the world. Yet it's also seen as a very nerdy and uninteresting and stuffy topic.
It is. Most people just take it for granted. You know, you've got some bills in your wallet, and when you go to the coffee shop, they'll give you what you need in exchange for those bills. Why give it much more thought? The book was difficult on many levels. The first was kind of this theoretical, philosophical, which is, how is it that I can take something that is just a piece of paper? I mean, there really is no more intrinsic wealth embedded in a euro note or dollar than just the piece of paper on which it's printed. You can't take it to a central bank and get gold or rice or anything official from the government. How is it that something with no intrinsic value actually works perfectly well, in the case of the $100 bill you mentioned earlier, all over the world, even though it's just a piece of paper? I mean, you kind of have to I spend a lot of time wrapping my mind around what money really is in an era when it's no longer a physical commodity. It's much easier to think about when you're using sacks of salt or tobacco, because you can always just use the tobacco or the salt. So that was hard theoretically. And then, of course, you get to the complexity of the financial system, and in particular, the financial collapse of 2008, which was a vastly complicated series of events, one causing the next. And I really had to wade into this connection between an overvalued real estate market and these complicated derivatives on Wall Street, and then the collapse of commercial and investment banks as a result. It's a long chain of causation, but obviously one that caused a lot of hardship for a lot of people around the world.
Charlie, you argue that money is memory. I thought that was really interesting, and it brings up so many different types of questions. And one of them is that memory is never certain. So can you talk me through that?
Yeah, so one of the ways to get your mind around what money is that it's just an accounting of who's provided services for whom. So if, for example, I'm here in my little New Hampshire town and I go cut somebody's lawn, and they write a little piece of paper saying, Charlie cut my lawn, I now owe him 1 hour of work. And then I go somewhere else and I, you know, give someone some apples from my backyard, and they write a little note that says, Charlie gave me 10 apples, I owe him roughly some kind of food with similar value. Then those little pieces of paper are a record of the fact that I have provided something of value for someone else. And that's the memory. That's the money is memory part. And of course, you know, that's what a paper dollar, instead of cutting the lawn, instead of someone writing it down on a piece of paper, if they just gave me a $20 bill, it would, of course, be the same thing. That the $20 bill is a token of the fact that I've done something of value for someone else. So the money is memory. Now, you correctly point out that memory is never certain. So obviously, if I lose the $20 bill, or if there's an accounting dispute, or the bank records are lost, I mean, one of my great fears is, what if there's a cyber attack and all of my accounts at Vanguard are wiped out and nobody knows anymore how many shares of a certain stock that I own? So I think this is actually a very valid point.
It would be interesting to see, as a social experiment, if, you know, suddenly, as horrible as it sounds and as catastrophic, how would we, as not just financial systems, but as human systems, how we would all deal with that type of horrific reality, and how we'd all work together or not to recollect what we all owe each other or not. One of the interesting personalities in the book that you do go into heavy detail about, who I loved reading about, was the Hungarian-American investor and philanthropist George Soros. And he's a hugely interesting guy. His private life, it makes for riveting reading, let alone his different types of investments. And he seems to have a real curious engagement with the world. But how do you think he has changed our understanding of money?
Well, Soros made his money through currency speculation. I mean, this is, at the end of the day, George Soros is an interesting and influential figure because he's an extremely wealthy man who can afford to put his money where his views are. And all of that, not all of it, a high proportion of that derives from a single bet that he made against the British pound. It was back before the euro had been created, and the British pound was under great pressure with respect to the major European currencies, particularly the German mark. And the German government was, or the British government kept saying, look, we're not going to devalue the pound. We're not going to devalue the pound. Don't worry. Well, George Soros didn't believe them. And so he sold a bunch of pounds and used that to buy German marks. And then, of course, when the pound was in fact devalued, he was able to buy back even more pounds with the German marks that he had purchased. It was a complex transaction, but at the end of the day, it was just one very large and arguably very smart and bold bet against the British currency. All of his subsequent influence derives mostly from that big bet.
It was a magnificent move, and you know, I think we can all learn a lot from his guts and how he was able to deal with risk and complexity. But I'm just wondering, do you think he actually thought that through, and that was, you know, he came up with those risk variables, or do you think that it was his advisors? Because that type of instinct is quite something.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is that at the end of the day, the advisors can lay out the case. But there's always somebody who is the person who has to ultimately give the say to put that much money at risk. And I have to say, looking back on the trade that he made and the circumstances around it and the British government arguably not in a political position where they would be able to raise interest rates, which would have protected the currency against what he was trying to do, they just didn't have the political temerity to do that because it would have caused a recession. It would have strengthened the currency because it draws investment into the country. But at a time when the economy was weak, it's very difficult politically to raise interest rates. Mm-hmm. When you look after the fact, the case is pretty strong that they were going to have to devalue the pound. And so I have to give Soros credit for kind of seeing that clearly before the fact. Mm-hmm. The rest of us can see it clearly after the fact. And that's, of course, it wasn't a bet on a sporting event where you really have no idea what's going to happen and somebody might get lucky. I mean, I think he really thought it through. He sorted out the politics and the economics properly, and it was a wise bet in the end.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with American academic and author Dr. Charles Whelan, whose new book, Naked Money, has just been published by W.W. Norton, where Charlie writes, like most carnival games, hitting an inflation target is harder than it may first appear. I asked Charlie about the psychology of pricing systems and whether it could be argued that measuring price is both an art and a science.
It does. And, you know, we all kind of take it for granted that when the government tells us inflation has gone up 2.1%, that it means everything is just 2.1% more expensive than it was last year. I mean, it sounds very precise. It is, in fact, a very precise number. But there is, when you open the hood on this, an extraordinary muddle behind it, which is, okay, well, let's suppose that the car you buy this year does in fact cost 2.1% more than the car last year, but the car I'm buying this year is not the same as the car last year, even if it's the same make and model, because this year it has the lane warning indicator that tells you if there's a car in your blind spot, mm-hmm. and it has the cruise control that slows down when there's a car in front of you, and it has the cameras that do lane assist. And so if the car costs 5% more than it did last year, how much of that 5% reflects quality improvements and how much of it reflects inflation? Mm-hmm. So there are actually people who spend a lot of time trying to sort those things out. Inflation is a much less precise concept than we might believe when we see the statistics in the newspaper.
But it is interesting how, let's say, take for the example of a car. You know, some people are very happy to buy a vintage car, an antique car, and, you know, live with the risks embedded in that. Whereas others, you know, buying a car for 60 or 80,000 grand, you know, a massive big thing, and then they pull it out of the car shop and it's depreciated within an instant. So, and some people get very hung up on all that depreciation. It's interesting how people think about it all, isn't it?
Well, it's particularly interesting because a lot of this stuff depends entirely on what somebody else is willing to pay. If you look at the art market, for example, there was a record set recently for a modern artist, a buyer, I think it spent $120 million. And of course, when it's something, you know, that has no useful value, like art or a vintage automobile, or even some kinds of gems. I mean, sapphires are beautiful. They don't have any real industrial use. At the end of the day, their value is derived solely from what someone else is willing to pay. They're not nearly as intrinsically valuable as you might think. If you've got a car factory, you know how much it's worth because it's going to produce cars and you know how much you can sell the cars for. If you have a 1962 Mustang, you know, it's not like there's a big business use for that. At the end of the day, that is a very valuable car because there are other people who are just as excited or more excited about it than you.
And you know, there's always going to be a market for uniqueness. I'm just wondering, what's the most expensive thing that you've bought apart from, let's say, a wedding ring, a car and a house, obviously, and maybe take out the college fees for the kids or whatever. But I'm just interested to know what you spend your money on.
Yeah, so let me say one other thing before I answer the question about uniqueness. Because the problem with collecting unique things is if the rest of the world loses interest in them, their value evaporates overnight. So when I was a boy, it was all the rage in the United States to collect beer cans, vintage beer cans. You know, if you found a 20-year-old can with a pop top, Bullfrog beer from Wisconsin was the most valuable can that you could find. And I had about 600 cans. I had a fairly formidable collection that was probably worth thousands of dollars at the time. Well, fast forward 30 years, when my mother insisted that I take these cans out of the crawl space in our house, nobody collects beer cans anymore. So this vintage collection, the only value I had left was recycling. I mean, the Bullfrog beer, people looked at it as kind of a rusted can and said, well, you know, what's so good about that? It doesn't even have beer in it anymore. So the uniqueness can be a bit of a dangerous game. So back to things that pay for that are quite valuable. Probably my home would be the most valuable. I'm not a big collector of valuable things, not a big collector of jewelry. I guess my wife has diamond earrings, but even they are not, it's not like they're huge and dangling off of her earlobes. So I guess I'm quite a functional person. Cars, homes, college education. I like to collect photography, but that's not terribly expensive. So I haven't put much of my wealth in those kinds of collectible things.
So you're not an impulse buyer. You don't get thrown by the moment and just go for it and just go out to hell. I love it. Like, no.
Things. So it's golf balls and picture frames. I mean, you can stand to be quite impulsive if they're only two-digit items.
You write something very interesting in the book. You write, bankers have done something unique. They have unified the world's major religions against them. Jesus expelled the money changers from the temple. Muhammad banned usury. The Torah directs that all debts be discharged every 7 years. The unifying belief is that money lending is somehow unjust and unproductive. The problem is when money lending goes wrong, namely when depositors rush the temple and the money lenders don't have money. If Jesus were a central banker, that would be his concern.
This is such an interesting point on so many levels. The first is, as you alluded to, all the different religions have balked at different points in history at the charging of interest. And the reason for that is we intuitively feel that work should be producing something of value, that nobody balks. If I go out and raise sheep and sell you the meat, nobody tells you that I'm a crook. If I build a house, I create value out of stone and bricks, people say that I'm a hardworking person. If I take idle cash, however, whether it's gold or dollars, and I loan it to you, and then I make you pay it back with interest, nobody believes intuitively that that's a productive activity. We just don't equate it as humans with raising sheep or building houses or growing crops. In fact, it's a very valuable function. If you can't afford to buy a house by writing a single check. You have to finance it with a mortgage. So somebody's going to loan you the cash, and they're going to expect a rental rate on that cash. So the loaning of money actually performs a very, very important function in societies and has historically. It's just that people don't view it as something on par with producing things. I think that's an erroneous view, but it is one that's been held throughout history. The other thing that's important in what you alluded to is that lending institutions are always prone to panic. The way it works is people in a community put their extra cash in a bank because it'll be safe there, and they can go get it whenever they want. The problem arises in the fact that the bank then turns around and loans out your money and my money to somebody else, so that if we rush back there and say we'd like our money back, they're going to say, well, we don't have it right now. We've just loaned it to someone who wanted to buy a car or buy a farm, and they can't give it back to us immediately, even if there's nothing wrong with the loan. So the history of finance is also the history of financial panics. And I don't know if it's popular in Ireland, but certainly one of those popular movies in the United States is It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart. And there's a bank run scene in that film that in many ways embodies all of finance.
Why do you think it is inflation is seen as such a dirty word? Because it is a kind of a brute reality of life. There's no getting away from it. But it's, you know, we get so angry and cheesed off, don't we?
Well, the reality is that somebody via inflation is robbing you of your wealth. If there's 2% inflation, what that means is that your money, if you'd stuffed it under a mattress or put it someplace where it's not earning interest, buys 2% less than it did last year. And nobody, you know, if somebody came to your house and said, I'm taking 2% of your money away, people would be quite exercised. And of course, that is exactly what inflation does. That 2% doesn't get people terribly exercised. And we can talk about why, in some respects, that may be a good thing because it helps lubricate labor markets and things like that. But if you get to a country like Zimbabwe, where inflation is so bad that people get to a point where the currency has to be weighed rather than counted, then an extraordinary amount of the wealth has been expropriated just because the currency has been rendered useless. So the reason people don't like inflation is because it takes away some of their wealth.
But, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Zimbabwe. If we look at other countries that have experienced currency crises or rapid inflation and unbelievably unpredictable inflation crises, let's look at, let's say, Argentina or Venezuela. It creates a state of panic and chaos for the citizens living in the country, for those doing business in the country. It's like guns to head stuff, isn't it?
Oh, it is. There, and to think about why it's so chaotic, just imagine that the money in your wallet is losing half of its value, in some cases, every day. I mean, just think about how you have to change your life. You're going to get paid at the end of the month. Well, you don't want to get paid at the end of the month anymore because your paycheck will be worth much less. So people get paid every day. Sometimes they get paid twice a day. Mm-hmm. And when you get paid, you don't want to put the money in your wallet because it's losing value. So you're going to rush out at lunch to buy whatever you can to get it in physical goods instead of currency. And, of course, everybody else is also rushing out at lunch to buy things. And at the store, they're changing the prices every hour because inflation is so bad. I mean, there are stories from South America during the hyperinflation when stores couldn't even mark items with prices because it took so much effort to keep changing those prices. Mm. And obviously, there are the stories of Germany between the wars when people are carting currency around in wheelbarrows. So it's extremely disruptive because everything that we count on currency to do, namely to facilitate the transactions that we make with goods and services, comes unraveled, and it causes all kinds of bizarre follow-on behavior.
But financial systems are predicated on trust and confidence, and within that, it's a confidence game. So you can understand how, whether it's employers, whether it's business people or employees or whoever is participating in the financial system, that it creates such a state of chaos. Because once trust has been eroded, it's very hard to settle down any type of panic, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And that's true in countries like Venezuela and Zimbabwe, where people have lost faith in the currency. Well, you know, why in the world would you accept pieces of paper? Man, we've talked at length about how they're just pieces of paper. If you now believe that that piece of paper will not be redeemed for what it was worth yesterday or even this morning. But it's also true in quite sophisticated places. At the height of the financial crisis in 2008, what happened was that huge companies, banks, firms lost confidence that their counterparties, the people who owed them money or were going to borrow money, would be able to pay them back. And as a result, they didn't renew their loans. They demanded to get paid back what they were owed. And once there was loss of confidence throughout the financial system, it essentially ground to a halt. Nobody would make new loans. And when the financial system grinds to a halt, it means that people can't get the capital, even healthy businesses can't get the capital to do what they want. People who are looking to buy a home because prices had plunged, couldn't get a mortgage. When you take the confidence and therefore then the credit out of the system, it just doesn't work very well.
How responsible are the financial regulators, Charlie, in terms of all the cock-ups and financial crises and panics that we've seen over the last few years? Because it could be argued that in certain countries, some regulators have contributed to the general sense of crisis.
Certainly some regulators have done better than others. If you look at the Canadians, for example, they suffered relatively little during 2008 because they have fewer banks in the United States and they're more highly regulated. So when you look at that comparison, it's clear that the regulators could have done a better job in many places, including the United States. We were well aware that housing prices had gone up precipitously and probably could not maintain the rate of increases that we were seeing. We had some sense, though not a complete sense, of how the mortgage market was acting in ways that were predatory, particularly towards less educated, low-income consumers. These people were being given mortgage products that if there were any drop in real estate prices or any sharp increase in interest rates, they were not going to be able to pay. And we had almost no idea how complicated the financial products were that were being manufactured on Wall Street. This is probably the place where the regulators fell down the most in the United States, because there's no way you or I could have any understanding of these complex debt instruments that were being cobbled together, where they take 1,000 mortgages, bundle them together, cut them into little pieces, borrow against them. I mean, these things were just dangerous financial weapons of mass destruction, is what some people call them. So clearly, the regulators could have done a better job. Now, that does not absolve the parties themselves. The fact is that many homeowners borrowed more than they should have. They were overly confident about increases in real estate prices. The banks and investment banks acted recklessly. The credit rating agencies, which are the entities that are supposed to look at these financial products and assess their creditworthiness, were complicit. They gave AAA ratings to some of these highly dangerous, highly leveraged financial products. So there's plenty of blame to go around, but certainly the regulators could have done a better job, both in terms of doing something about the rise in real estate prices, something as simple as requiring people to put more money down, which would have given them more cushion if there's a drop in prices. And certainly they could have done more in reining in some of these really dangerous and contagious financial products.
It struck me as I was progressing through the book that when we think of contributions people make to society, whether it's political contributions, social contributions, cultural contributions, or let's say great writers or great artists or great musicians, you know, we value how they have influenced society and developed society or opened society up. We don't tend to think, though, of economists. And, you know, they're kind of seen as a kind of a certain type of person in a certain and put into a certain type of box. You have profiled in the book some amazing men and women who have really contributed to whether it's America, Europe, or to society in general. And one of them who struck me as a particularly interesting guy was Milton Friedman. Can you tell me about him?
Sure. Milton Friedman is close to my heart. I got my PhD at the University of Chicago, where he taught. He was already gone at that point and died yet, so he came back periodically. Milton Friedman had a disciple by the name of Gary Becker. I believe Friedman was on Gary Becker's dissertation committee. Gary Becker was another prominent free market thinker, and Gary Becker was on my dissertation committee. So I feel, you know, perhaps overstating it, that I'm, you know, I'm part of that Milton Friedman lineage. And, you know, Friedman's many contributions include waking us up to the cost of too much regulation, too much government involvement. There are plenty of thinkers who've pointed out correctly, I would say, the things that governments need to do to make markets work better and to make our lives better and to cushion the vicissitudes of capitalism. But Friedman pushed back against that and said, well, there are a lot of cases where when individuals are left on their own, they're going to do better than what government could do for them. And there are cases when government tries to protect us, say, by licensing certain service providers, by saying you need a license to be a chiropractor, where maybe we'd be better off with that, without that license, because it would allow more people to do the job and we could choose the ones we think will provide the best service and so on. So Friedman, I think, was a breath of fresh air, pushing back against this kind of steady belief that more government was always better. But there are plenty of things I disagree with, and I think the financial crisis probably suggests that we need more regulation than Friedman would have called for. But it's always refreshing to read the way he thought about policy issues.
You talk a lot about the mysteries of the Bitcoin, and I have to confess, I didn't know much about it. And it all seems particularly complex, and it's very hard to pin down. But I'm just wondering, do you think with regards to the future of money that it will all go electronic eventually? Like, we do all our banking electronically, people are dating, getting married practically on the internet. Like, when you think about it, we have all types of artificial intelligence and robots. So presumably, it's all going to go like that, is it?
I think most of it will go electronic. I don't think cash will ever disappear entirely for a couple of reasons. One is, for small transactions, it's still just easier in some cases. You know, for a dollar here, or if you're in a rush, there's a certain anonymity that comes from cash that we discussed earlier that I think some people may want to cling to for small transactions. But the gist of your assertion, I agree with completely, that we're going to go more and more electronic, because that's also easier in some respects. It's very nice for me to get a credit card statement at the end of the month that tells me exactly where I spent my money. It's easier to account. It's easier for governments to collect taxes. It's easier to root out black market activities when everything is electronic in their records, which is, of course, exactly why Prime Minister Modi got rid of the big rupee notes in India. Now, that said, there's an important distinction between moving money and making transactions electronically in rupees or dollars or pounds or euros and Bitcoin, which is an electronic money that has no government backing, has no regulation or anything of the sort. So I do agree that we'll be using electronic transactions, but I believe it will still be denominated in currencies supported and regulated by governments as opposed to by using Bitcoin.
Lastly, Charlie, I was very interested to read that you went for Congress in 2009 and unfortunately unsuccessfully. But I presume that experience changed how you view what we do with money, whether it's governments or cities, and how they plan and organize their money and their spending.
Well, one of the reasons I ran, this was in the special election after Barack Obama was elected. He appointed Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff. Rahm Emanuel was my congressman. And that created an open seat, and I ran for that open seat. One of the reasons I ran was that I was concerned, and remained, by the way, very concerned about the U.S. fiscal situation. The United States is running debts that are now approaching 100% of our gross domestic product. Other countries have run bigger debts, but they don't have economies that are as large as the United States. The United States is now sucking in a high proportion of the world's capital, and the bond markets seem still very comfortable with that. Interest rates are low. But to me, it's a situation that breeds vulnerability. So I'm concerned about America's fiscal situation. That's why I ran. Now, I am also concerned about America's political situation, particularly the tribalism of the two parties and much of what we've seen. But that's a much longer and perhaps more depressing conversation.
And just interested in one final thing. If I gave you a billion or 10 billion, what would you do with it?
I would start a third political party in the political center. I mean, in some ways it follows from what we just discussed. I think that the greatest danger to the United States and therefore to the rest of the world is political dysfunction. And the two parties, the Democrats and Republicans, both of which have much to recommend them, by the way, but they've been dominated by their extremes and they are now completely incapable of solving some basic problems. What I think we need is a third political party in the middle, not unlike what Macron just did in France, that would be able to bridge the gap between the two. And sadly, in the United States, you need a lot of money to make anything political happen. So I would take all of my billion and I would build a political movement.
And that was author, academic and financial journalist Charles Whelan. Naked Money, A Revealing Look at Our Financial System, is published by W.W. Norton and retails for just under €16 in paperback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the cogent words of American economist Paul Krugman. The tragedy of the Euro mess is that the creation of the Euro was supposed to be the finest moment in a grand and noble undertaking. The generations-long effort to bring peace, democracy and shared prosperity to a once and frequently war-torn continent. But the architects of the Euro, caught up in their project's sweep and romance, chose to ignore the mundane difficulties a shared currency would predictably encounter. To ignore warnings which were issued right from the beginning that Europe lacked the institutions needed to make a common currency workable. Sobering words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.